You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about pond building or dam building. It'll be a little bit of a homestead update as well, but for the most part, we're going to talk about our recent major project, which is building a couple of ponds, and kind of our lessons learned and some of the things that we did along the way as well. So hopefully help those interested in this kind of thing to go forth and build and hopefully learn from our mistakes. But first, for the worldview segment, I want to talk about an article that came out from politicaloutcast.com. And the title is New York Times Declares Traditional Marriage Absurd. Now, this is an extremely important topic that is occurring right now, especially with the Supreme Court looking at same-sex marriage, with all of the transgender issues occurring, with Bruce Jenner coming out, with all that stuff going on right now. This is a huge, huge topic. And it's so important. And a lot of people ask, well, why is this the only thing you ever talk about? I say, well, it's so vital in our culture right now. It's absolutely critical to the Christian in American culture today. Okay, so with that, we have this article. And what it's talking about, I'm not going to read to you the article. And there's a couple quotes that I do want to read to you. Now, so recently we had Ireland just declare same-sex as a nation. We have our Supreme Court looking at this right now. It's supposed to be coming out with a ruling very soon, maybe today. And so if our Supreme Court drops the hammer and says, basically, it's the law of the land, stand by, folks. I mean, there's so many more implications. It's not just about live and let live and all that. Here's the bottom line up front. When Bruce Jenner declared that he is basically the new normal, okay, the new normal is LGBTQ, IP, whatever else they've tacked on, that's the new normal, okay, even though it's 2% of the population or less, when you add all of them together, when you talk about just quote-unquote transgenders, it's less than 1% of the population. It's like 0.4 or 5%. Okay, and then when you add in another 1.5% for homosexuals, that's 2% of the population, and this is transforming the United States in its laws and everything else. Okay, so the first thing is you got to understand that there's a deeper thing happening here. It is of a spiritual nature, of course. This is a battle, a spiritual battle. But on a practical side, people are using this whole homosexual agenda and all these other corollary issues to push their own agenda. This socialist Marxist agenda is being furthered through this these issues. Okay, this is not about, you know, the highest powers don't care about homosexuals and their ability to marry. In fact, I heard something so absurd the other day, and essentially what it was is someone was supporting the homosexual agenda and saying, look, it's not like people are lining up to get married anyway, so what are you guys worried about? It's like, well, if they're not lining up to get married, why are we putting so much emphasis on it? Okay, and the reality is that traditional marriage, biblical marriage, that has been the norm, the normative throughout human history, to include biblical history, and I understand that there's many, many examples outside of one man, one woman in the Bible, but it doesn't matter. That was God's original design. One man, one woman, joined together, becoming one flesh. Okay, that is the design of marriage. That is the ideal, if you will. And if we do not see it that way, we reap the consequences of those actions. Okay, the whole reason that the state became so involved in marriage is because it conferred a benefit upon the state. The state benefits from one man, one woman marriage. All right, let's just talk about that for a second. They've proven over and over again, men are tempered when they get married. Okay, they become a little bit more even keel. That's of course not to say that all do, but if you look at it from a practical standpoint of crime is reduced greatly among married men. Okay, so that marriage is a benefit to the state. It makes society go round. I mean, that's the bottom line. The other thing is that heterosexual marriage produces children. And the bottom line is the state needs the population to continue. Okay, and that's having children. So it's procreation. All right, I'm sorry, but transgenders and homosexuals do not produce children. They don't produce them. Period. They need. I don't care what you say, and most would say what I'm speaking of now is absurd. But it requires a third person. Bottom line, that's just the truth that they can't get around. Okay, they cannot have children on their own. All right, so there's no real benefit conferred on society by homosexual marriage. All right, that's the truth. But anyway, we get to this article. Of course, Ireland, we know, just collapsed and fell on this issue. We suspect that our own Supreme Court will lay down a progressive decision and make it the law of the land. But we've already started to see tyrannical approaches, you know, with regards to Christians and this issue. If you stand firm on this issue, which you should and you need to, you will be persecuted. Okay, we have many Christians losing their businesses. We will very soon see, if the Supreme Court decides this, we will start to see ministries, we'll start to see colleges, we'll start to see churches eventually lose their tax-exempt status and all that. But it'll get worse than that. Okay, that's minor. We should be very willing to let that 501c3 status go. Okay, if you're a college and you're accepting federal money, and they tell you you need to change on this issue, otherwise you're not going to get federal money, you should say, bye-bye, federal money. That should be your answer. But many won't. In fact, many aren't doing that now. All right, so this article. Here is it's called the Iona Institution. It's a conservative Irish think tank that led to the campaign to try and block that homosexual quote-unquote marriage in Ireland. And, of course, they lost. It was a hard-fought campaign. They came out afterwards with this statement, okay, quote, "Going forward, we will continue to affirm the importance of the biological ties of motherhood and fatherhood." Okay, that was from the Institute. Now, the New York Times editorial page responded with this statement. The absurdity of that statement speaks for itself. Think about that for a minute. What I just said, which was very gentle, very non-confrontational. Okay, one more time. Going forward, we will continue to affirm the importance of the biological ties and of motherhood and fatherhood. That's what they said. That's not some highly controversial statement. The New York Times said the absurdity of that statement speaks for itself. Okay, here's what's happened. And Bruce Jenner illustrates this for us. So when he said, basically, I am the new normal. Okay, Caitlyn Jenner. What he said is, I am the new normal. All right, so now what are Christians to do to that? Well, how are we to respond? Well, let me show you how a lot of Christians have responded with something like this. Live and let live. Just pray for them. Stop speaking out. It doesn't bother you. If it doesn't hurt you, just stop. Just be quiet. It's not affecting us, and it's not a big deal. Okay, that's our statement. We are supposed to love. That is what a lot of Christians are responding. Not all. There's a lot of people speaking truth and speaking out. And the reason they're speaking out as we are commanded to speak this truth. We are not to sit by and watch this without at least calling. And that's not a condemnation on Caitlyn Jenner. I'm not condemning him. All right. What I'm saying is the celebration of what he's doing by our society is the much bigger issue. Okay, he needs the gospel. He needs salvation. And someone hopefully will get to him and be able to speak truth. And but the issue here that I'm addressing is the greater celebration. Okay, it's the Isaiah 5:20 world that we live in. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. All right, we're proclaiming that. So he is the new normal, and that's the narrative throughout, you know, the progressives and liberals and even your mainstream Americans who don't want to be seen as a hater or somebody who's discriminatory. Okay, but here's what's happened. By making him the new normal, Christians have now become the abnormal. By Caitlyn Jenner coming out of the closet with his transgenderism, Christians are told to get in the closet. And right now they're just being told to do it and shamed into do it. And on the fringes, they're having the force of law used against them. That's going to increase, and you need to be prepared for it. Okay, so when people tell you, as a Christian, that you should not speak up, then you need to understand. One, you need to say no. Our job is to proclaim truth. We preach the gospel. We proclaim truth. You need to go back and read the Great Commission, and don't forget the verse that's right after. You know, go into the world, make disciples of all nations. And, of course, this is Christ speaking, teaching them all that I have commanded. Okay, we're not just trying to get people to say the sinner's prayer. Okay, we're to teach them all that God has commanded. That is over all of life, every area. Okay, so the normal that is now the LGBTQIP agenda makes the traditional biblical Christian position abnormal. Okay, so we are commanded to speak up. We are not to sit on the sidelines. Speak boldly with gentleness and respect. Okay, I'm not saying, you know, denigrate Caitlyn Jenner. I'm not saying to bash him, call him names, and all this other stuff. But we're to speak truth and speak it boldly. Okay, before we get started on our main topic for today, I just want to make a quick plug for our workshop coming up on July 18th. So July 18th here in northern Idaho. If you just contact us through the website, so that's sovereignsunrise.com. Again, sovereignsunrise.com. So sovereign and then sunrise, all one word. It's sonrise.com. Okay, so we're going to be covering our workshop, our homesteading workshop, introduction to homesteading. But our kind of twist is we come at it from a permaculture and preparedness perspective. Okay, so all those things, homesteading, permaculture, preparedness, all kind of wrapped up in one into a good introduction to homesteading workshop. We help people understand, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. Changing their mindset, different methods that they can apply. Obviously, we advocate permaculture methods, designing a food forest. We do a walking tour. We cover all kinds of different spots and how we show really how we do each aspect of what we're doing. How to choose livestock, working with small livestock, so backyard poultry and rabbits, cow or goat. Deciding factors if you want to go down the dairy route. And then we also do a milk challenge. So we put before raw dairy, both cow and goat, and see if people can tell the difference. Most people cannot. Growing and processing your own meat. And I do a demonstration as well. So all the way from dispatch to full dress. Food preservation methods and more. Okay, so that's coming up on July 18th. All right, now I want to get into our main topic for today. And like I said, it's mostly going to be on building ponds or dams, depending on, you know, Australians like to use the terminology dams. In America, we more often will use ponds. It's the same thing. It's water storage used via earthworks in order to slow spread and soak water. In this case, we're storing water. So obviously you're slowing it. And we're storing it in this case. And so many benefits to ponds on a homestead. We put in two over the last few days. I wanted to do one more, but I couldn't get the excavator where I wanted to do it. Do the third one. That's okay. Well, that's a future project. Overall went well. And we have some serious lessons learned, though. One significant mistake that I made that I'll share with you here in a little bit. But ponds. So ponds for storage. So basically anywhere, you know, there's lots of different ponds, types of ponds, and I'll talk about that. But anywhere where there basically the precipitation exceeds the demands of evaporation, transpiration, then that could be a place for a small dam or wetland or swamp. And all those areas are good for homesteads. They're great wildlife reserves. They help drought-proof a property. They also help moderate when there's flood. You know, there's many different benefits. It can be used for aquaculture. Okay, so you could run fish in there, or diverse plant and fish, or waterfowl. So our plan is for ducks and maybe fish later, but also to plant some plantings. So some water-loving plants great obviously around ponds, and maybe even some water plants in the pond with little islands, little floating islands where you can grow watercress, things like that. It would be kind of cool. So we're going to look at all those kinds of things. That's what we've been wanting to do. And so we built a decent size. It's not huge. It's not like a one-acre pond or anything like that. But it has quite a bit of volume. So there's some deep areas or some areas that go all the way to probably 8 feet deep, maybe even a little deeper. And then obviously some shallower areas as well. What we made is what is called a valley dam. Our main one. The other one was just a small, it's more like a silt pond to help catch the silt that we can then capture that silt and use that. It's great material for growing. But a valley dam is made in a valley, or if you think of it as a draws and fingers, you understand that's a draw dam. So it goes in the lower area where, say, just imagine looking at a landscape and you say, okay, water, when water flows a lot, it would flow through here in a little channel. Maybe it's a little seasonal stream, or maybe it's a full-on stream. Okay, so this would be, for us, it is an area where it becomes a seasonal stream. It's spring or seep fed. All right, so a lot of runoff and a lot of water that's coming up out of the ground in different areas feeds this to make it a quote-unquote seasonal stream. So that stream flows maybe 5 months out of the year. And we're doing some strategies to try and increase that. All right, so this valley dam is where you take an area, you look for a good area to do it. And an area is that's good would be a place where you can put up the dam wall. So think of the wall that actually holds back the water, just like a dam. Think of the Hoover Dam. All right, that huge dam holds back all that water. Okay, this is the same thing on obviously a much, much smaller scale. So you want to find an area where you have to make the least wall for the most storage, if that makes sense. Okay, so you want to find an area where it's a steep area with a lot of catchment. And we had one area like that, so that's where we put it. We built up a dam wall, and then as it rains, it probably is not even going to fill up until this coming fall. But that's okay. We just kind of missed the rains by a little bit. Ideally, and this is a lesson learned, you want to make a pond at a time when it will quickly fill up. Yeah, that's the ideal. And we do have some water flowing in there, but it's pretty low flow. that's going in there. So that's what we did. And there's lots of other different kinds of dams. That's the one that we made. And again, we're hoping to do aquaculture in the future. So we'll watch it over about a year to see how it does. Does it fill up and does it stay filled? Or do we have to work on any leaks, things like that? And once it's fully sealed, then we can look at aquaculture, but we have to make sure that it will support fish year round. Or maybe it's basically a growing season. Maybe we grow trout from March through late fall and just try and take the times when there's not much ice, things like that. All right. So there's a lot to think about there. If it has enough replacement over time, water replacement, that it stays unfrozen, then we might be able to keep fish in there year round. But it just depends. But like I said, other plants as well, and then ducks. We're going to be running ducks, and this is a perfect place. And here's the cool thing. We just finished it yesterday, and we're still working on the aesthetics and all that kind of stuff, and we've got planting to do. But in the very first evening, as we were looking out over at the dam, we saw a snowshoe hare, of course, this time of year they're brown, not white, run over to the pond and get some water and then run out of our pasture. All right, so you might say, no, you don't want rabbits around your gardens. Nah, I'm not too worried about that. We've got plenty of 22s and dogs to take care of that. We didn't shoot the rabbit, okay? It was cool watching this immediate impact and just the slightest amount of wildlife start to come to the area. And one of the things we're hoping to do is it's going to attract wildlife. And it will. I guarantee it. And attract amphibians because it's so good for the area. It's good for bug control and all that. And many reasons. Okay, so we're hoping to hear frogs and you know that kind of thing show up eventually. So that was really cool to see. Especially on the first day, and it's going to get better and better. Okay, the second dam that we built is a small dam above the main dam. And the purpose of that dam is eventually irrigation. And we built it above the main dam and above the swales. In fact, we built it in a way that essentially it's a decently deep-sized hole, and it's a small dam that probably can hold couple hundred gallons of water. Okay, and then it has a spillway, a spillway where it fills up and then it overflows back into the little stream, seasonal stream, and then goes down and then it connects with the main dam. Now, in between those two, just below the small, call it silt pond, it has two purposes. It's a silt pond, so it collects silt that runs off and down there, so hopefully it keeps the main dam a little bit cleaner. And it's also going to be, or the hope is anyway, that it's an irrigation point. All right, so like I said, it's just above our swale. So my hope is that I'm able to gravity feed those swales. If I want to water the swales, if I want to fill the swales with water, I can do that through this little silt pond. And I don't need anything. I don't need pumps or anything like that. Just gravity. I'll have a pipe going through it with an elbow. Think of the elbow sticking straight up. And if I want to run water through it, I move the elbow down so that it's now under the pipe itself will go under the water level. You move the elbow down. Now all of a sudden there's water flowing through it. On the other end, I can move another elbow to either side of the little stream into the swales. Okay, so that'd be a very simple way to irrigate the swales without using power at all. All right, so that's why we set it up that way. And it is also technically a little valley dam, but it's very small. And like I said, it has those two functions. So it's silt collection, it's irrigation point, and then also, you know, the ducks will be in and out of there as well. And by the way, some people might say, well, you know, you don't want manure in there. And no, I don't. I do want manure in there because it's nutrient. It's nutrient. It's going to go into swales, which doesn't go directly on plants. It goes into a channel And then once that water soaks in, it kind of keeps going downhill a little bit, and it irrigates all the trees and plants that are planted on the downhill side of the swale berm. And so that's the functions of those. We won't be using those for livestock watering. Okay, that's not the purpose. It's, even though I really, if, as long as there's enough volume, it probably wouldn't be a big deal at all. But that's not going to be our primary. And in fact, the bigger livestock will be fenced out of these dams and the seasonal stream. Okay, so we're going to use rainwater to water the animals. And we use the stream water to irrigate and provide aquaculture opportunities, waterfowl opportunities, wildlife attraction, all that. So that was really, really cool how that worked out. I wanted to do another one, a third one above that silt pond. So I would have a series of three dams, and we will eventually do that. But I just couldn't get the excavator over there. It was slipping too much, and I thought I was going to get stuck, so I just backed out. No big deal. In fact, if they're small enough, we can dig them by hand pretty easily. All right, so, and it's also, of course, emergency water. All this could be used for emergency water. If you had to filter it in multiple ways, you could use it. You certainly could use it for things like flushing toilets, and watering, you know, watering gardens, all that can be used. So great achievement. Now let me talk equipment and money, okay? Because this is important. So we rented an excavator, a pretty decent sized excavator, 13,000 pounds. Now there's excavators out there that are way bigger, three times the size of that. And they're just massive. I mean, those things are for clearing large forest areas and huge trees. And even though we were able to knock over some big trees with this excavator, but it's probably considered a mid-size excavator. And so we rented it. I've never run an excavator before, but figured it out pretty quick. I think it was, honestly, the fact that I flew helicopters in the Marine Corps allowed this me to transition to an excavator pretty quickly. Multiple controls and everything else. But I think anybody could figure out an excavator in a couple hours. So that was cool, and it was a lot of fun. Man, is it a lot of fun. Really enjoyed it. It's amazing what you can do with that equipment. So it was just awesome. Now, here's some people would say, you don't want to use a big machine like that. You know, you're using a bunch of fossil fuels and all that. Well, I don't buy that. Here's the thing. What we just did, I'm going to tell you everything we did in just a minute, but what we just did, even with just the pond, that pond, as long as it was constructed well and, you know, would require a little bit of maintenance now and again, should last for theoretically hundreds of years. Now think of that. Hundreds of years of all of those uses for generations for that amount of excavator use. I think that's pretty good trade-off. Now, we rented the excavator for 3 days, three full days, three 24-hour periods. And generally how it works is you have a certain amount of hours that you can use per day. And if you go over that, as far as, you know, seat time, if you go over that, you're going to get charged extra. Okay. So if, in this case, it was eight hours of houred meter time a day. So that's 24 hours of operation in 3 days. Yeah, that's a lot of seat time running an excavator, a lot. And we did. We put on 24 hours. We put on just under 24 hours. Fortunately, we were able to, there was two of us able to run it here. So we just took turns. So, you know, we put on that full 24 hours. For 3 days rental, this is what we got done. We got done the two dams. We cut a channel. So we cut a spillway and cut a channel all the way back down into the stream. Okay, so think of a dam in a valley, and then think of it fills up, and then it goes over a spillway, and then it goes back down into the natural stream bed. Okay, so we cut all of that And then a second smaller dam. We cleared an area behind our barn for future expansion for another hay barn or a barn expansion. So that was probably in, I don't know, maybe a half acre or an acre clearance. Not quite an acre, a little less than an acre clearance. We were able to take down six very large trees that were sick. So we had a couple lodgepole pines that were dead, dying, and in the way. And man, you just push them over. It's so awesome. So much more work to do it, even with a chainsaw. So much more work. And we put in a new pistol range in another area. Probably about 20 feet wide and a good 25 meters long pistol range. Dug it out, built up nice big berm. When you're in down in the range, say shooting on the 10-yard line, you've got an 8-foot berm in front of you. You got a nice big, probably 8-foot berm on the left side, and then and behind that is forest, and it goes uphill. So it's very, very good placement of a nice new pistol range. A lot more work to do down there, but we were able to do all of that in 3 days on 23 plus hours work on an excavator, which is excellent. All of that, just over $1,000. That is incredible. I mean, it would have easily been triple that, easily, to bring someone in to do it for us. Easy. It might have been four times that. Who knows? I didn't even get any estimates. Now, did we take some risks? Absolutely. You know, my first major pond build, bottom line. I mean, I know how to do it. I've read about it. I've watched it. But it's entirely different to see how to do it, to read about it, and then to actually do it. Okay, so there were some great, like I said, some great lessons learned. Glad we did it. Yeah, we could have paid someone to come in and do it. But, I mean, the experience gained is immense. And it's going to help me when I help design other people's property. When I'm able to go in and look at dam sites, I'm going to have an even better understanding now than just basically a book knowledge that I've put in a dam. I've put in spillways, and I've done it now a few times. And with my lessons learned, I'll be able to help them and make sure that they, as they go forth and either contract or do it themselves, I'll be able to give them some good tips to avoid. All right, so lots of places to put in ponds and dams on a property. Of course, you know, if you're on flat ground, you can just pick a low spot. You'll want to pick a spot that is naturally wet, okay, because obviously that's where water tends to gather. It tends to run off there, maybe, because there's always slope on your land. Unless it was leveled by a machine, perfectly leveled, there's going to be slope in almost every area. But you got to look for those opportunities on your property. You don't just look for an area, well, it'd be really pretty to have a dam here. No, you got to look for those areas where you're building the least amount of wall for the most amount of storage. That's what you got to look for. Okay, and sometimes it's a mix. You've got to pick a site where it makes sense. Okay, so there might be a little bit of compromise, but you'd never want to build a dam in a spot that requires so much earthworks that, you know, for very little value. The energy in for what you're getting out of it needs to make sense. Okay, one of the principles of permaculture is the least amount of energy input for the greatest effect. Okay, that's what you want, and then that's how you should think about building ponds as well. Not all landscapes can cost effectively store this proportion of free surface water. Okay, so all this water catchment you're doing, sometimes it doesn't make sense. Okay, and there might be other things you should do instead, like large rainwater catchment projects in tanks or something like that. Okay, so that would be another way to approach this. I could have had large tanks, and then I could pump from the seasonal stream and store it in the large tanks. But for us, it made sense. But one of the things that you need to make sure that you do prior to is that understand your soil that you're working with. Okay, so one of the things we did a long time ago, last fall, is we built a little test pond where in the area where we now have our large pond. So we dug a hole just by hand, you know, just kind of testing it, and it was really rocky. Okay, so we knew that there was going to be some challenges there. All right, some major challenges. But it's such a great site for them. You can overcome it. So that, I'm not saying that this can't be overcome, but you have to think about that. If you have a large amount of draining soil or deep or coarse sand, if it's extremely rocky, it might not work. It might not hold water, is I guess what I'm saying. Or maybe you don't have to worry about that because it's an annual stream and that you're kind of maybe diverting some of it in a pond. So you're getting constant flow. So maybe you can get around some of those things. So in our case, we can get around that to a large degree. Plus, I am hoping to be able to fully seal it, get it fully sealed after just a little bit more work. And I'll talk about it here in just a minute. The other thing is that you can't put a pond in if it's too steep or if it's too unstable. It becomes a massive cost to put in a dam on something that's very steep. I mean, think about all the earthworks that need to be done. Like I was telling you, we did everything. We did a pistol range. We cleared half an acre or three quarters of an acre, and we built two ponds and spillways, and all for $1,000. Okay, you are not. I mean, most people, if you hire, you're going to pay way more than that for a decent sized pond. But there are things you can do. And what you're looking for is, as far as soils, if you are blessed with clayish soil, it might be a problem in some ways for you. You have to be careful how you garden and things like that. You have to take extra precautions because it holds water so well. Well, that's great for a pond. And that's great. And we have some areas of our land that have really good soil content. We have other areas where it's a little bit more gravel-like and less clay. All right, so and what you're looking for is somewhere around 40% or more clay content of your soils. And even if, like, I called around and talked to some people in case I needed to truck in some dirt, and say, hey, how's the clay content? And honestly, most people really couldn't answer that question. So you're really going to have to search around and find people who specifically work with earthworks, if that's what you want to do. Also, so as far as slope, as far as cost, you want an area that doesn't have steep slope. Now, what percentage of slope? I don't know. You're gonna have to figure that out. You want a little bit of slope is good, but a lot of slope is bad. So you just gonna have to eyeball that. If you have to build a dam wall that's 20, 30 feet high, it's gonna cost you an immense amount of money. Just think of it like that. If you can build a dam wall that's 6 feet high and it holds tens of thousands of gallons of water, that's a great deal. Okay, so you're just gonna have to look at the area is gonna determine that. So that's what you want to think about when you're looking at an area site. So not only is it a good potential to store a lot of water, but is it going to work there with your soil? Can you get the equipment in there to do it? If it's going to be something that you can't dig by hand. All right, so let's talk about some types of dams. I already told you that we did a valley dam. First one I want to talk about is a saddle dam. Now, if you think of a skyline, if you've got some terrain on your property or you're going to be looking at property in the future, this is usually the highest available point for storage too, which is excellent, which you want. If you can store water above you, that's great because you can gravity feed. If you can store it above your animals and all that, you can gravity feed, and that's ideal. For us right now, we couldn't do that. So our two dams are below our home and everything else. Now, we've compensated for that in other ways with rainwater catchment and other strategies. Eventually, we'll do some pawns above us. But this is what we needed to do now. Okay, so a saddle dam is usually at the highest available point. And if you think, okay, just look at a mountain and you picture a saddle, a literal horse saddle, you know, that is where, you know, the lower point between two high points. Okay, that's a saddle, and that would be a place for you to build a saddle dam. If there's enough rainwater catchment up there, surface runoff up there, where you have to do some earthworks here, but you could build that water storage up high and then gravity feed down below. Okay, so that would be awesome if you have that opportunity. So it's high storage, you know, that you can use for stock, wildlife, etc. So that would be a saddle dam. And again, I have to reiterate, gravity feed is what you want if you can. All right, ridge point dams. So this would be the opposite of a valley dam. This is a ridge point dam. Now here, generally speaking, you've got to do more of a horseshoe as opposed to us that really did really just one wall across the back in the valley. And that's pretty much all we had to do. Well, on a ridge or the high point, for those of you that think of it draws in fingers, this would be a finger dam. And it might sound counterintuitive. You're like, why? Water runs off of those. Why would I build a pond there? Well, you want to bring water to the ridges if you can. That's the whole purpose of swales, is it spreads that water out. It takes it from the low areas and takes it to the higher areas on contour. So again, it's not obviously you're not going to push water uphill by itself. But what you can do then is have diversion drains or diversion swales that feed this ridge dam. All right. So again, you can think of it as a horseshoe, because you obviously have to build up the sides as well. A little bit more earthworks here, but it can be very good for some of the same reasons as a saddle dam. So you might be able to hold water up high and do gravity feed. You're bringing the water to the point where the water is hard to get to. Okay, low areas is where water stays, and it wants to go to higher areas. You have to make it go to a higher area. All right, so that would be a ridge point dam, the opposite of the valley dam, which is what we've done. Okay, contour dams. Now, this is especially important. You don't want to do this on a lot of slope, just like any of these. But this is built on contour, and I've talked a lot about this before as far as swales, and we do have lots of swales now, where you dig a ditch on contour as a water harvesting ditch, and then it spreads the water out, slows it down, and then it soaks in, and it's great for planting. This would be a little bit more earthworks involved here. Think of it, a larger swale with more volume, so it's on contour. But you're making it more of a dam instead of a water harvesting. So the goal of a swale is that the water soaks in. You actually don't want it to be a pond. You want it to soak in. In this case, you obviously want it to stay. All right, so that's just you might have to add in a little bit of clay, or if you have clay, you're going to compact it, using a machine or by hand or whatever. A contour dam is great. You can, again, irrigation, of course. You can even do aquaculture if it's designed correctly. You might be able to put fish in there. You can have it connect to swales, so it's easy to flood irrigate or just irrigate swales. So think of you have a network of swales, and then you have this contour dam that's in line with these swales, and then that you can let out water when you want to flood the swales and do irrigation that way, which would be awesome. There's some definite advantages here. We've talked about valley dams in detail. All right, so let's talk about a little bit of construction techniques and some things to think about, and then some lessons learned, and then I'll leave you with that. So we can build dams on any site if you have enough material, if you have enough money, if you have the right machines. Okay, but we, again, take into account all those things that I've been talking about as far as slope and location and things like that. So you can build it anywhere. But you don't want to do that. Again, the least amount of energy input for the greatest effect. So first thing, do a test. Just dig a little test hole. Check out, see what you got as far as clay content. If you take that material and you squeeze it in your hand, and if it's looking like something like Play-Doh, you're golden. Okay, especially if it holds together in a log, you're golden. If it holds together pretty well, you probably are okay. If it crumples apart, you're in trouble. Okay, so you may be able to dig deeper and deeper and deeper to a point where you want, and you may be able to hit a clay layer lower. Okay, so don't just stop a foot down. You got to dig down. In fact, you got to get down. If you want to do a really small pond, let's say 4 feet deep in the center, dig down 4 feet. See where your layers are at. See what you got. So that would be the first thing I would do, is do a bunch of test ponds or test holes to figure out what you got. And then from there, let's say you find a good spot. Well, that's great. So then now you need to plan out. So what I would do is I'd go out there with an A-frame level. This is what I did. Go out there with a bunch of little flags and mark out what you want. All right, as far as water level. And you've got to think about a few things here. Okay, when you're marking out your little flags where you want your pond. One is obviously water will come up to the contour line. Okay, it's going to come up to the level line. So it's good to get an idea of a contour line. So I marked out our contour line around the dam and just kind of stepped back and looked at it. In fact, I just looked at it for like a day or two and just to figure out, okay, does that where approximately we want the water line to come up to, or somewhere below that? Maybe that's the pond, above the pond edge or something. And you need to, think that through. All right. Because you'll be surprised at sometimes where you thought, oh, well, I thought the water would come here or there, but it's not. On one side, maybe it will spread out a lot more or less than you thought. Maybe you need to rework it. Okay, so that kind of gives you an idea of where you need to put your dam wall and where the edge of the water is going to be, and then how high your dam wall's got to be. Because remember, you need your dam wall to go above the water line. Okay, well above. If you're talking about major pond building, you probably want a freeboard, which is, okay, think of the pond being full, and then from the waterline to the top of the dam wall, that's your freeboard. It's the same thing on a boat. Okay, if you're, like I said, if you're talking about major earthworks, you want that to be about 3 feet. So after you design what you want to do as far as your dam wall, now it is a matter of getting to work. Now, if you're going to use a machine or if you're going to dig it by hand, the first thing you actually want to do is the area where your dam wall is, you need to dig a trench right there. So that would be the first step after you've mapped it all out and you've picked a good spot based on all those factors. Dig that trench out. And I know it sounds counterintuitive, and it was for me until I kind of learned out why. Dig that trench out down quite a bit, all right? So you want to go down, 3 or 4 feet, maybe even a little bit more, okay, depending on the size of your pond. I'm talking about a decent-sized pond here. If you're going to dig a little hand pond, you don't need to do any of this. But a major pond, and I consider ours like on the low end of major, I guess. If it's going to hold tens of thousands of gallons of water, to me it's major. But that's relatively just not that much. So you dig that trench down, and what is that? What that's called is the keyway. And so you're actually digging down below where the dam wall is going to go, and you're going to build the keyway. All right, and think of that as just a really solid area where water can't penetrate through. All right, so then what you're going to want to do is start layering down material. So remember that you know, clay content material. So you're going to lay down, so call it 8 inches of material, and then you're going to compact it. And hopefully you can use a machine or you can use a roller or whatever you got. If you got to get down there with a bunch of people and you're jumping up and down, that's what you got to do. You know, if it's a smaller one, that's what you got to do. For us, ours, you know, some of these huge projects are so wide, they get equipment literally to track roll back and forth through there on these keyways for compaction. Okay, because it's all about compaction. For us, it wasn't that big, but we were able to use the bucket of the excavator to kind of tamp it down. Okay, that was our method. And so then once that's done, you add another 8 inches, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again to build up. And then you keep going, and you build it all the way up to your level, your the height that you're going after. Okay. Now here's what's important. You're not making a wall, a straight up and down wall. You need each side to have slope. Okay. And preferably a 3-to-1 slope. Now maybe more. So maybe a shallower grade if it's a really large dam, or maybe you can get away with a little bit steeper grade if it's a smaller dam. All right. But you don't want a straight up and down wall. It's just going to erode over time. But if you can just imagine, okay, so if you put up a wall and then you throw up against the water, it's going to slowly erode over time. So you don't want that to happen. So you want to try and get slope in there. Otherwise, you're going to end up doing repairs later. So you might as well do it right the first time. Okay, from that point, you want to start then, once that's done, you want to start, you know, be working on excavating the hole. Now you might have to do some of that excavation to provide material for the keyway. In fact, you will. So this is all kind of happening at once. So you pull out the material for the keyway and you put back in some of that material. But if you just imagine when you're compacting that all down, that's not even going to fill up what you dug out. Then you're going to start pulling stuff from around you, from in the quote unquote pond area, to use for that. Now, if you're blessed with that kind of material, then you can do that. If not, you got to bring in material from the outside and use it. We had to do that. We had to bring in a truckload of filled dirt to be able to do that. And it still wasn't enough. But I'll kind of talk to you how we got around that. Okay, so you tamp it down, build up your wall. Make sure you've got a good slope on either side. So if you were to look at it from the side, it would be a trapezoid. And so you just want to make sure that those slopes are not too steep. And at the same time, you're then excavating your pond. Here's a huge mistake that we made. One, we underestimated the quality of the material that we had. We said, oh, it should work. You know, the clay content's good, but the problem is there's so many rocks. So it was, you know, kind of that mix of good material and lots of rocks. Okay, so lots of rocks, this drainage. Water will get through a lot of rocks. The clay is going to stop it, but if there's rocks in there, it's not going to stop all of it. So our mistake was, is that once we realized, okay, we're having problems and I've got to get some material before I build this keyway, I just decided, okay, well, I don't want to stop progress. We'll get it some material in here the next day, but I want to continue. So I continued to excavate the main pond area, and this turned out to be a huge mistake. And we did that, and we got it all out, and we had this big giant hole. And we're like, awesome. Day one, we dug the keyway and we excavated the entire pond, backed out of there. And we're like, yeah, let's celebrate. You know, that was a lot done for the first day. Well, and I need to add, prior to this, we dug a diversion channel. Okay, so we diverted. We're getting a lot of seepage still. Our seasonal stream's not flowing, but there's still a lot of seepage, so there's still a lot of water that's flowing in there, which is great, which means our land is hydrated. The soil is hydrated. It's holding water, and I really believe that the swales above it are helping that. But what's happening then is that water's coming into the pond area. It's wanting to be a pond, which is awesome, except that you don't want a 13,000-pound machine that costs $60,000 to get stuck in the pond. And it turns out that once we dug it all out and backed out, it was like very muddy and way too precarious to bring that excavator back down in there to work on that keyway and to work on the pond for the track rolling the pond. So with that said, we no longer were able to bring the excavator back down in there, which, like I said, it was a huge mistake on my part. What we should have done is stopped right there, brought in the material, and then worked on the keyway, got that done right, then started next. Once we figured out that the material on site wasn't going to work, we should have brought the material in, fixed the keyway, and then excavated as we were able to back out. So excavate, excavate, track roll, excavate, track roll, and then back your way out that way. So you do it one time and you're out of there. You don't have to go back in. All right. So what did that mean? Well, it means that we had to figure out another way to get around to that, to the dam wall, to the keyway, which worked out. But it was a lot of extra work. It was a lot of removing fences and going around different areas, things like that. But we made it work. Quick word about fencing. We've decided to use it almost exclusively cattle panel and T-post. Very glad we did. Cattle panel comes in 16-foot segments. Very easy to remove and put back. It's easy to repair. If you ruin one panel, which we did, we can put that right back. It's a little bit more expense up front, but it's well worth it and labor saved and reduced maintenance. And we brought in material and had a neighbor come over and use his front loader to help us out with moving material into to the keyway area. Then we used the excavator to pack with the bucket. So that was awesome, and it was great to have. It's great to have neighbors that are willing to lend a hand too. I just called them up and said, "Hey, can you help me out with this?" No problem. Comes over, and all we needed him to do was to front load all the material that we had trucked in over to the site. Okay, because we didn't have a way to do that besides a little utility vehicle and a little trailer that would have taken a long time. In his tractor, he did it in a couple hours. Okay, so that was awesome. And then we started packing it in. We built up that wall. Our dam wall is pretty big. It's pretty big. From the backside, it's probably about 6 or 7 feet high. And then so as we dug out the pond, it's on the pond side, it's probably in the deepest area, 8 feet above. And so our deepest portion of our pond will be somewhere between 8 and 10 feet. But as the some materials are inevitably going to get back inside and, kind of flow down, especially right now before we planted everything out. So that's going to fill up a little bit, and that's fine. That's what we wanted to do, because that'll hopefully help seal the pond, because we were not able to bring in a bunch of extra material for the pond area. I know it's not fully sealed right now. Now that's okay, because the other strategies that we're putting in place, of hydrating the land above it, of running it through the seasonal stream. So it's going to stay full at least 6 months out of the year. And then as we work on it over time, we want it to become year round, which, I mean, it's got water in it right now. It's just not very deep. It's probably 3 feet deep at its deepest right now, which is great. So those are some factors in actually building the pond that you need to take into account. Now, what are some things that we're going to do now? Well, we're leveling some areas. We're just kind of repairing, with having that 13,000-pound machine through your pasture is not a good thing. So we're doing some repairs. We're adding some additional fencing. So we're fencing out the large livestock. from the seasonal stream and the ponds. We will run ducks through there, as I said previously, meat ducks. And they'll be able to work those ponds for us. And we'll be doing some planting. And like I said, we may end up doing some other types of aquaculture, maybe fish, you know, certainly plantings, water loving plants and trees. We'll go around it. And you know, all this is to help stabilize the pond area and help it last for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, if you're going to plant on the backside of a dam wall, which is where we are, you have to keep some things in mind. You cannot plant trees that have these, you know, giant tap roots or anything like that. Okay, it'll break apart the dam and eventually might cause, you know, some leaks. So you want to pick water loving plants that don't have large tap roots, like willow or bamboo, or you can just do some ground cover stuff, things like that. That would be fine too, or grasses. You know, all that would be appropriate choices for something like that. You want to stabilize it. So we're going to be planting it very soon, today and tomorrow. Because you want to be prepared for that and be ready to put that stuff in to let it come back in. All that would help just to stabilize over time. And you want to plant all the way down to the water's edge if possible. It'll slow down erosion and keep that pond nice and clean. And, you know, those are some very important points to consider when building. There's so much potential here. So let me just review real quick and give you a couple bullet points. Keep in mind, you've got it when you're building the dam, you got to keep in your earth type, you know, so you have the appropriate clay content. If not, you've got to either bring it in. You've got to use maybe a membrane. So a lot of people will use those pond liners. And I guess if it's a really small pond, you can do that. Now, we weren't going to do anything like that. Now, you can bring in things like bentonite to help seal it. That just finds its way into all the little leaks and clogs them up. And there's other methods too. There's a lot of people will bring in animals. They'll bring in either a lot of cow manure, or they'll bring in pigs and like fence them in there and have them work that area really well. All their manures and compaction will help to seal ponds. So there's some unique opportunities there as well. And who knows, maybe we'll do that with our pigs and to help seal it up. And they'll have a ball with a little bit of water that's in there. I just got to make sure that they're going to be okay. So those are some ways that you can seal it. You got to make sure if you're going to build a massive pond and there's stuff downstream of it, you got to be sure of what you're doing. Now, most people aren't building dams that big, but if you can build some small dams above your property, that even if it did break, worst case scenario, it's not going to hurt anything. I mean, in most cases, 20, 30,000 gallons of water is not going to destroy anything if it's got a channel to flow through. But you want to keep that in mind. You want to keep in mind all of your available catchment or diversion. So another thing we'll be doing is diversion swales to help divert water. So our swales are connected to the seasonal stream, which is connected to these ponds. And that was all by design, because we want to maintain it on our property as long as possible. Other than that, you know, the different types of dams that you can build are innumerable. I mean, you can build it anywhere. It's just the expense and the effort required, which is going to be the biggest factor. But definitely consult somebody if you're not sure what you're doing, or at least do your homework on it. Let me talk real quick. One last thing about the spillways. All dams should have a spillway. Your plan cannot be, oh, the water fills up and then it flows over the dam wall. Unless it's a really tiny pond, then that's fine. But you need to build a spillway. So in other words, it fills up to your designated freeboard level, and then it's going to start flowing over into a spillway. And the spillways are very important. This is where, I mean, if you have a large rain event, whether it's a 100-year, you know, rain event, or even just a large rain event, your spillway has to be able to handle that full pond and that full flow. So not only do I need to keep into account just the general catchment area of the land that kind of flows here, I've got to take into account the seasonal stream, and I've got to take into account the swales that when they spill over into the seasonal stream, that comes down into the ponds. Okay, so I've got to take that into account. So I've got to make sure that spillway is nice and a lot of water can flow through it. Okay, in most cases, most of the time, a little bit of water is going to flow through it, and it's not even going to come close to fulfilling the capacity of the water, but you have to plan for that 100-year rain event. So let's talk about determining the amount of water that you need to deal with real quick. So we have to determine the catchment area, and how we determine the catchment area is you need to calculate the size of the area that where water is going to flow into the pond, obviously. Now, if you think about land, if you're looking at land and, you know, let's say you've picked a valley dam like we did. So I can look up at the terrain and I can kind of see, okay, there's some high ground over there. There's some high ground over there. Everything in between, you know, all the way up is my catchment area. So I'm going to give you an example, and I'm going to keep nice, easy, round numbers to illustrate this, hopefully. Okay, so this is just, again, what we're doing. We're determining the size of the spillway. That's what we're doing. So if we start with, let's say we have an area that is about 2 acres of catchment area. Okay, so you look at your valley and you have determined roughly that between those two ridges or those two fingers, depending on how you read land, there is a 2 acre catchment for this area. So what we'd want to do then is calculate, okay, what's the square footage of that? And let's say we come up with, and this is very close actually, a little bit over 2 acres, about a hectare is roughly 100,000 square feet. Okay, it's actually 107,000 square feet, but let's use 100,000 square feet. Okay, that's our catchment area. And without looking at the math behind all this, let's just calculate this out real quick. All right, so we have our 100,000 square foot water catchment. And what we do then is we calculate that maximum rain event. Okay, that 100-year rain event in 24 hours. Okay, so what's the maximum? What's the record? Look it up in your area. What is the record rainfall in one 24-hour period for this area? You use that. Okay, so I'm going to use, because I'm where I'm at here, in Idaho, the maximum rain event in a one 24-hour period is a little bit over 7 inches. Okay, but I'm going to use 9 inches because I'm going to give myself a little bit of buffer, and I'm going to use 9 inches for that. What that comes out to be for that 2.5 acres-ish is 504,900 gallons of rainwater in that 24-hour period. Now, that is a lot of water, right? That's a lot of water, 504,900 gallons. Now, if we divide that by 24 hours, that gives us, 504,900 divided by 24 equals 21,037 gallons of water an hour. Okay, now that's a ridiculous number to think about, because how do you calculate that when it really comes down to a spillway? Okay, well, let's divide that by 60 or 60 minutes to figure out how much is flowing per minute. 350 point something gallons a minute.
Okay, so all right, starting to come into play now. But it's still kind of hard to figure out. All right, you know, what does that actually look like? Okay, so let's divide that by 60 again. So how much per second? 5.84 gallons per second. All right, now I can deal with that number. So the maximum rain event where everything, I mean, is flowing, you've got almost 6 gallons of water flowing over that spillway per second. Okay, that's a lot of water. It really is. But it's not that hard to see that you can design a spillway to handle that amount of water. Okay, and again, you have to figure out your catchment area. So, you know, maybe your catchment area is 20 acres, and then you start getting these big numbers. Okay, but again, so what we're using is something reasonable to think about. So if I want to look at that 6 gallons per second that's coming across the spillway in a max rain event, well, how can I think of that? Well, just, I don't know, line up 6 milk jugs, set them side by side, put them across your spillway, and just think about that for a second. Does that make sense? And if it doesn't, then you just make it a little bit wider. Okay, so that's how you would calculate out your spillway. So your spillway is designed for the 100-year rain, max rain event over 24 hours. All right, so that's just a quick word on catchment area and how to calculate your spillway, how to think about it. And if you're just not sure, then just make it bigger. Okay, you can't go wrong by making your spillway just a little bit bigger. Ours is about 3 feet wide, 3 or 4 feet wide. Okay, it's plenty for what we need to do. And yeah, that's pretty much it. That's an example of catchment and how to design your spillway based on that calculation. So it doesn't destroy your dam. And if you do that, your dam will literally last maybe forever. So that spillway should be very carefully surveyed. It should be on the, if you have a higher side and a lower side, it should go on the lower side. Okay, that's less work that you have to do. Less earthworks. So if you think of your dam wall that's set up, and then think of the spillway, say, next to it on the lower side, that's a good strategy, and that's what we did. And we're still doing some work on it. We're still, you know, widening a little bit. We're going to layer it with rocks and everything else so it doesn't erode very easily. So it needs to be well thought out, and it should be thought out for that max rain event. And calculating all the factors. So if you have drainage, diversion drains, then that area that catches needs to be taken into account. Now, we talked about sealing leaky dams. So you can use bentonite. You can use animals. You can bring in more material, more clay content material, and just compact it. Roll it. Roll over it. Roll over it. Roll over it. Jump up and down on it. Whatever. Now, if it gets expensive, if you start bringing in clay, then again, it's very expensive if you bring in a pond membrane as well. So if you bring in big plastic or neoprene or something like that, or even concrete, that's very expensive as well. So I'd look at maybe even bringing in animals or maybe some bentonite, stuff like that. Volcanic ash, things like that. Which really is what bentonite is. But that would work too if you had some access to, for whatever reason, if you had access to that, I would try that. This is basically all we have on ponds. If you have any specific questions, let me know. But it was a great experience. Lots of lessons learned. I would have nailed that keyway first before I set in. Working on the main part of the dam, and I would have done a better survey of my type of soil. I thought I was going to be able to get away with it, and I would have brought in the other material first and had it ready to go, although it really didn't slow us down, because as I was waiting for that material, I went and cut a new pistol range, so it all worked out. So 3 days, hard work, 2 ponds, spillways, diversion drains,
clearance of about a half an acre, knocking down six big trees, and building a pistol range, all for $1,000 and a lot of work, but well worth it. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.